From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in California in 2014, and maybe you'd heard the story on NPR. That's why I'm focusing on this one. You might have heard these headlines. Researchers at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory told NPR then that they thought they had finally succeeded in a form of fusion. You know, fusion, the dream of clean energy, an endless source of energy, capturing the equivalent power of the sun. Well, fusion has been floated as a kind of salvation for climate change. But Gizmodo relayed an old joke about fusion energy. It's the energy of the future, and it always will be. It's funny, right? The idea that affecting fusion is so difficult that science might never get us there. But if you're a researcher, you know that science tells us it is possible. It's out there. It's within reach. So you keep trying. Well, in California, researcher Omar Hurricane told NPR that they had finally figured out how to squeeze fuel with lasers, but even that supposed breakthrough didn't create a whole lot of usable energy. In fact, taxpayer watchdog groups later declared what was going on there a waste of money. Well, at the University of Rochester, hope continues, with progress of the sort that might actually lead to a breakthrough everyone has been hoping for. And that's what we're talking about this hour. What is fusion? How does it differ from fission? How would fusion work? Could it be a balm for climate change? And when? Let me welcome my guests for the hour. They include Michael Campbell, Deputy Director of the Laboratory for Laser Energetics. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Ricardo Betti is here, Professor and Scientist at the Laboratory of Laser Energetics and Professor of Mechanical Engineering. Ricardo, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Arijit Bose is here. He's a PhD candidate working on a thesis on the very subject, and I'm going to ask you to get nice and close. There you go, Arijit. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, well, you guys knew that old joke about the energy of the future and always will be. Mm-hmm. But Michael, I'm just going to start with you. Are we someday going to declare that fusion is not the energy of the future anymore? It's the energy of the present?
Yes. I mean, fusion is extremely challenging, as you mentioned, and as anyone who studied the field knows. You know, fusion and fission were both discovered in the same decade, you know, in the 1930s, many, many years ago. You know, fission was discovered in a German laboratory, you know, in a crude laboratory at that time. Fusion was discovered by a famous Nobel Prize-winning physicist to understand why the sun could be older than the Earth. So it shows you the challenge of fusion. Fusion required looking at stars. Fission required looking at an experiment. Fusion requires, the difference between fission and fusion is very simple. Fission requires room temperature. Fusion requires 100 million degrees. So we have to make matter at 100 million degrees and control it. And that's the challenge.
That seems like a challenge, yeah, in many ways. And I think before the program began, you gentlemen were pointing out the fact that discovered in the same decade, but it took, what, 3 years for fission to really sort of get off the ground, and fusion, here we are decades later. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, we make fusion every day. We just don't make it enough to be relevant for energy. It's actually the way we make it nowadays is more of a sink of energy. So we have to supply more energy in than we get out of fusion. But there are ways to get more energy out. And there is man-made fusion that works. Fortunately, works in the forms of thermonuclear weapons. But we know that fusion works. It just we had to make it work in a controlled fashion in the laboratory. And that's what's very hard because, as Mike said, it requires temperatures of 100 million degrees.
Why is it that if it works in the form of a thermonuclear weapon, which is not the form that we'd like to see humanity use fusion energy, why is it that decades later we still haven't been able to harness it in a more scalable, usable way?
Well, I mean, in nuclear weapons, we have a very effective trigger of fusion reactions, which is a fission bomb, an A-bomb. It's actually nuclear weapons work with an A-bomb triggering an H-bomb, which is the fusion bomb. And so we have now replacing, basically, the trigger with a laser to make it in the laboratory a much smaller scale. And so you have to understand that now the laser can deliver a lot of power, but not as much energy as an atomic bomb can deliver to the fusion fuel. So we are talking about very different scales. But eventually, we will make it work. It's just a question of when. Because there is no basic physics that is going to prevent us from achieving this.
Is this, in your eyes, you know, we talk so much about solar energy, we talk so much about wind and other forms, and kind of this mixed energy future. But if fusion is successful in the way that you are describing, could it circumvent the need for these other forms? Could it be a clean energy source that helps us stop using carbon, stop polluting in the same way? Is that overpromising or is that possible?
No, I think, you know, in the long run, you know, the world of 8 or 9 billion people will require energy. You know, if anyone looks at the quality of life directly correlates with energy availability for agriculture, for clean food, for clean energy, for transportation, for heating and everything else. And so fusion will play that role. The question is when. I mean, you know, my own belief is that future energy will have a mix of things. I have solar panels on my roof. You know, it powers my house during the day. Maybe there'll be batteries that will make it powered at night. But you will need, advanced civilizations need power, and fusion is an ultimate energy source to do that. But because, as I like to say, fusion is nature's way of making energy. And John Kennedy once said, on Earth, God's work must truly be our own. This is a hard problem. And so the time scale, and I think the fusion community has dealt with this in a difficult way, is to underestimate the time it will take not only to do the science, which we know we can do, but then to transform that into useful energy.
It seems to me, just observing from the outside, there's this old rule of thumb, or at least when I was growing up, they used to say that our technological achievement doubles every 7 years. I don't know if that's true or not, but the bottom line is scientific progress has been so remarkable that there's almost an impatience with fusion, I would think. You know, that's why we see funding occasionally imperiled. And Ricardo, you wanted to weigh in on that, something else there?
Well, I wanted just to highlight, one aspect of fusion energy. There are, you know, different clean source of energies, right? I mean, there's solar, there's wind, and so on. I mean, the difference with fusion is that fusion provides very high power densities. That means that you can make the energy that you need with a very small footprint, because you can make it within a power plant like you make it, you know, with current nuclear reactors or coal-fired power plants or gas power plants. It would be the same thing. It would be a fusion power plant. But this footprint will be very small because of the high power density of fusion. That's what differentiates fusion as a clean energy source from the other clean energy sources.
And fusion doesn't have nuclear waste, which would be as a result of fission, you would always end up with products that are radioactive, and you have to somehow dump them in a place which doesn't affect the environment in the long run. So in that sense, like, fusion is cleaner. And if you compare it with greenhouse effect or global warming, fusion wouldn't emit those global warming gases. So in that sense, it is very important.
And so, Arijit, you're saying when we talk about radioactive waste from nuclear energy, we're talking about fission, not fusion? Is that?
Yes, we are talking about fission. Fusion will not have that.
Okay, and I already had an email from a listener just asking about possible risk there. And we can circle back to that. Listeners, I should also tell you that because the first Monday of this month was a holiday, we didn't have our traditional monthly science roundtable, which is always the first Monday of the month. So this is sort of its replacement for that. And if you've got questions or comments on this, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Let me read from that piece in Gizmodo that was sort of decrying our apathy or derision for fusion. And we'll see what our guests think about this. Quote, "While our cynicism about fusion may feel justified because of the lack of progress, it's also unfortunate because despite tepid support and constant funding peril, researchers are making progress toward this futuristic energy source. Scientists will eventually solve fusion's immense technical challenges if society can commit to the journey." And they talked to Clayton Myers, a plasma physicist, who says, quote, "It almost sounds too good to be true, this concept that we're going to have a limitless carbon-free energy source. But the nuclear physics says it is not. It is proven that fusion reactions are real and that we can make them." Essentially what we've been saying, but agree, Michael?
Yes, we agree with that. I mean, and actually, the world spends a lot of money on fusion, not just the United States. I mean, there's major activities in Europe and China and Asia. And so, you know, the U.S. in some fashion, you know, it's inconsistent in its support at some level. But there's more commitment in for fusion energy in other countries, which I think is a concern for this country. We don't want to buy our fusion power plants from China. We'd like to have them domestically produced and understood. And so it's important that the United States plays a role. But there's also, Rigi said something about safety. I think one of the other attractive things about fusion is, as Ricardo said, has a very small footprint. But also, it never can have a meltdown. Because it's so hard to make fusion, it's easy to stop it. If something goes wrong, fusion stops. So the fuel stops. So the burning stops. And so fusion, in terms of evacuation, in terms of location, because of the, you know, the challenge of what happened in Japan, what's happened in Russia, would not happen in a fusion power plant. It cannot have a meltdown because the fuel, first, is very little fuel involved, and secondly, it's 100 million degrees. I can tell you, as soon as I cool it down, it stops. And so it's a very fundamental difference between fission and fusion, because fission continues to generate heat even when the reaction stops because of the products are still radioactive and they're hot. Fusion doesn't have that.
Okay. Ricardo, you want to add to that?
Yes. So, for fusion, there are, two aspects in the fusion research right now. And the first, we need to demonstrate that we can ignite fusion fuel in the laboratory. That has never been done. People have been at this for 60 years, and this hasn't been done yet. We are getting closer, and this is, the results that you saw in the press release. It's about getting closer to igniting fuel for the fusion fuel for the first time in the laboratory. The second part is once you demonstrate that the fusion fuel can be ignited, and so it does work, it does produce energy, then the issue is the engineering of making that energy into a commercially and economically viable form that can compete with current nuclear reactor energy, current coal-fired power plant and gas power plant and so on, and solar and wind and all of this. So the engineering is daunting. So it's a very, very difficult problem, the engineering of fusion. So once the fusion fuel has demonstrated to work in the laboratory, the engineering aspects to make the fusion fuel useful, to make commercially viable electricity, is going to be a daunting challenge.
Okay. And Rajit, you agree with all that?
I do agree with all that. So we are currently, as Ricardo mentioned, in step one, which is to show that we can ignite in the laboratory. Then the next step would be step two, which is the engineering challenge, like Ricardo said. So, yeah, I absolutely agree with all that.
The other part of that article that concerned me a little bit is I think the juxtaposition of the fact that 60 years later, 70, 80 years later, we're still here without commercially upscale and viable fusion power, combined with the fact that we are looking at rising global temperatures and the impact of climate change on, I'm not meaning to be alarmist, but there's some concern that there's an urgency that must be here. And here is what one of the researchers told Gizmodo, quote, "The challenge with fusion is finding a technical path that makes it economically attractive, as you said, and that's something we can do relatively soon. Our view is that if fusion is going to make a difference to global warming, we have to go faster than we are now," end quote. Any disagreement there?
No, I agree.
No, we all agree. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. And so let's talk then about some basic questions I have about what's happening here, not only at our laser lab, but you mentioned a ignition point. Is mm-hmm. that, should we start with some definitional
yes.
terms here? This is
mm-hmm.
important to understand here. So I'll follow your lead here. What's
yeah, I mean,
ignition
igniting fusion fuel is like, it's not very different conceptually than igniting gasoline, okay? You ignite gasoline every day when you turn on your car engine. The way you ignite the gasoline is in a cylinder of a car engine, where you compress the fuel and a spark from the spark plug ignites the fuel. So we are doing pretty much the same thing. We are generating a spark in the laboratory to ignite fusion fuel. Now, the spark that you have to generate to ignite fusion fuel is a very different spark than the one that ignites gasoline fuel. It has to reach, in our case, it has to reach 100 billion atmospheres of pressure and temperature of roughly 50 million degrees.
Okay.
So as you can see, that is a very demanding spark. And the way we try to get to those conditions is with lasers, because lasers can deliver energy in a very, very small volume and very, very quickly. So the timescales that we are talking about here are billionth of seconds. So we had to deliver energy. The amount of energy that we deliver to generate a spark is actually rather small. So in, at Rochester, if I think about the largest laser in the world, which is the Livermore laser, they deliver roughly, it's called 2 megajoules of energy, which is roughly the energy content of a donut. So it's not a lot of energy.
500 calories.
Right. The energy content of a donut, but they deliver that energy in billionth of a seconds. So that makes the equivalent in terms of power, which is energy over time, of hundreds of terawatts. So if you think that the United States electrical grid is only 2 terawatts, the power of the Livermore laser is about 500 terawatts.
So the United States' entire electrical grid is 2 terawatts?
Yes, 2 or 3 terawatts.
Michael, you want to...
No, it's about 500 gigawatts.
500
gigawatts. But the total power the United States uses, and the total power
the total
in the
power,
world...
Sorry, uses, yeah. is the, 2 terawatts.
The total power, the whole world, if you took every electrical output, measured the power in every car, and every boat, and then every airplane... It's about 13 trillion watts, and a trillion is a million million. The NIF laser in California generates 500 trillion watts, but the lights don't go out for the world because it only does it for about the time it takes light to travel a foot, because light travels about a foot in a billionth of a second. So it's a very, very, very short amount of time. And just to elaborate what Ricardo said, the spark, the pressures in the spark are the pressures in the center of our star. So you see this is the challenge of fusion is to be able to achieve those conditions in a controlled fashion in the laboratory. So what we're making is miniature stars that have the same physical parameters except for size as you find in the center of the stars that make fusion every day for us.
Sitting here in this conversation, thinking of this past weekend where I stopped at a throughway rest stop. Have you ever stopped at a throughway rest stop and had to use the restroom? You think there's no hope for humanity. And then you hear what they're doing and harnessing the power of a star and you think, I cannot believe the same species is capable of both of these things. It's really, really amazing. But if it's traveling, if it's the equivalent of light traveling a foot here, how do we take, take me through what the research is telling us and what's happening now to make this more, and I'll start with Arichin here. Go ahead.
Yeah, so let me back up a bit and tell you about what efforts are going on in terms of laser-driven fusion. So what we do is So the energy that is in a donut, like 500 calories, we shrink that amount of energy in a very short region of space and in time. So in terms of space, we are talking about like 4 millimeter cube of size. And in terms of time, we are talking about 100 millionth of a second. So we have to pump all that, like the energy, which is not a lot, into this really small space and time. That is what the laser does. Now, when the laser shines, so there are two different approaches of laser-driven fusion. One is indirect drive, which is what people at Livermore are trying to do.
And indirect.
Indirect drive.
Yep.
Yep. And the other is direct drive, which is what we at the laser lab at University of Rochester are trying to do. So the so in indirect drive, the laser energy is converted into X-rays. And the X-rays are used to drive the target. Whereas in direct drive, we circumvent that conversion into X-rays and drive the targets directly with the laser. So if we do that, then we effectively save the conversion into X-rays. So we drive the targets directly with more of the laser energy compared to what indirect drive does. So it is, in some sense, a way to circumvent that, and therefore we can pump in more energy into driving the target, and therefore we can get more energy out of it. So that is in terms of research what we are doing.
Okay. Ricardo, pretty good explanation there?
So, yes, I mean, there are reasons why our Livermore colleagues have adopted the indirect drive way of driving a target is because X-rays has some advantages, even if you pay a penalty by using ultraviolet laser light to make X-rays, because there is a big penalty to do that. The X-rays are very uniform. It's a very uniform hammer that if you use it to compress fusion fuel. So instead, if you use directly the laser light, that is not a very uniform hammer. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, like squeezing a balloon using your fingers, and then you have the balloon squirting through your fingers because it doesn't want to get compressed. So if you have a uniform piston, a uniform hammer, then you can compress better.
And with bigger hands is required.
Right, bigger hands, that's right. And also some historical reasons, because X-rays, it's what's used in H-bombs. So they have a very good understanding of how that works. So our Livermore colleagues, since Livermore is a weapons lab, but they know much better. They have a good understanding of X-ray-driven implosions. So that's another reason for them to use X-rays rather than directly laser light.
Okay. Michael, anything to add there?
Well, I think that's a good explanation. I mean, there are complementary approaches. I mean, you know, as we're at the still stage of fusion research where we don't know what is the best way to do it. We know what we need to do. And so I think at this stage of the scientific research, having a multitude of approaches, each with its advantage and disadvantages, and or challenges, a better way of saying it, is the right thing to do. And so, you know, we applaud the results of the NIF laser, that recent result. That's a very nice result because, as Ricardo will say in a minute, he will explain how good that was and what implication that would have for the future. And then Arici will explain what we did and how the implication of the direct drive approach was too. So I think that we should recognize the achievements have been made. And as the colleague you read about, you know, fusion continues to make progress. It's very hard, and you know, something this valuable, you know, again, is not going to come easy. And I think that's one of the things that people have to realize. Sometimes, you know, we had the Manhattan Project, and so we had an atomic bomb in 3 years. We had the Apollo program, which we had land on the moon in less than a decade. But remember, the Apollo program, you know, who designed the Saturn V rocket? The person who designed the V2 rocket in Germany. So it was a multi-decade problem, you know, of research that people have done. So fusion is a much more challenging scientific and then technical problem. But at the end, we all believe, you know, I want my son and my grandchildren to live in a good life with energy abundant for them all in a world that accepts it.
All right. We're going to continue to talk about, again, the results of and the implications of what's going on in the laser lab. But let me get a few of your listener questions in. John in Brighton, first up. Go ahead, John.
It's Don.
Oh, Don. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah. Well, one thing you've been talking about the difficulties, but you haven't discussed at all the fuel. Now, are you using just regular hydrogen, or do you have to use deuterium or tritium?
Yes, we have to use the easiest fusion reaction is between deuterium and tritium. And so right now we are concentrating on deuterium and tritium fusion. As you probably know, tritium has to be produced because it's an element that decays with a 12 years lifetime.
Yeah.
So we acquire tritium from other labs to do our experiments, right?
Uh-huh. Now the deuterium is done by fractionating of regular water?
Yes. There's about, I think, 1 every 7,000 molecules in seawater is deuterium. And so it's to be extracted from the seawater.
How is that done?
Well, since the isotope difference is so large, you know, between deuterium and hydrogen, it's easy done with lots of different ways in which masses are separated by diffusion and other things. I'm not exactly sure exactly how it's done, but I know it's routinely done.
Okay.
And it's a simple one, just because the isotope separation is so large.
It's twice as heavy.
Yes.
But by the time you dilute that difference in water, the molecule of water may only be one of them as deuterium.
Well, when people have looked at the economics of fusion, and again, we have a long ways to go before we can really look at that, the extraction of deuterium from seawater is a very small component of what the cost of electricity would be. And you can buy it now pretty easily. It's not like helium or other things. It's relatively straightforward to get.
Okay, well, thank you. I just felt people were, you know, we were talking about the difficulties, but people should have an idea. What is the fuel?
Absolutely. And I like to say, you know, 1 gallon of seawater has about 360 gallons of gasoline, and when you're done, you have 6,999 over 7,000, so the water's still there.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Thanks for the phone call. And let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back. And, for those who are still on the skeptic bandwagon for fusion, Jake, one of our regular listeners and one of the really sort of avid science fans and aficionados in the audience, he has a few questions for our panel, and we'll come back and continue the discussion of what's happening at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics and with fusion. If it all sounds sort of abstract and too big to get your head around, think of it more simply this way. Our guests are working on a problem that this is the kind of work that could eventually lead to a truly clean energy future, and it does seem like a big get here. It does in some ways seem out of reach, but Science often feels out of reach until it's not. And Michael Campbell, Ricardo Betti, and Rajit Bose are here. They're talking about the work that's being done at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics on fusion energy. It continues next. Coming up in our second hour, the Chief of Cardiology at Highland Hospital, Dr. Chad Teeters, joins me, telling his personal story. He's a guy who loved smoked meat and a broad-ranging diet, but he changed his lifestyle to vegan this past spring. And Dr. Teeter says he's lost more than 50 pounds this year alone. He's getting ready to make a public presentation on going vegan, and he'll talk about it next hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections as we're talking about fusion energy as our future. And we're not there yet. We're a long way away still. But some of the work that's being done at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics could help get us there. Now, Jake's a skeptic. I'm going to read his comments here, and our panelists will respond to that. He says, the engineering problems at best here will take decades to work out. Why are we wasting our money on fusion test experiments that we know can't work if we don't have the core materials and technology? Just my opinion, but the funding would be far better off spent on fundamental materials and technology research, not these great behemoth tests, at least not yet. I'm going to start with Ricardo. We'll go around the room. What would you tell Jake?
Well, I mean, this is an issue that, you know, we have been battling for a long time, right? So, I mean, it's a good point, okay? And it could be that the engineering challenges for fusion are so daunting that fusion may be too late. So by the time it's ready, maybe there are other energy sources that will be available. However, I mean, fusion offers really some unique advantages. As I mentioned to you before, it's not just the fact that it's a clean energy source, but it's also, this is a really attractive aspect of fusion, is the high power density. I mean, all the other renewable energy sources, they are low power densities. So solar, wind, and so on. So that's why fusion is so attractive. Now, while this observation is absolutely valid, what I would say is that if there is significant progress in fusion, let's say that we are able to ignite fusion fuel for the first lab in the laboratory, and then this comes with a scientific recognition that it is an achievement to do this for the first time, because it's a difficult thing to do, and we have been trying to do this for 60 years, then my feeling is that there's going to be a lot of good, bright people entering the field, they're getting interested in fusion, that a lot of the engineering problems that seem so difficult now to solve all at once, but once you have a lot of good people working on this problem, things are going to get better a lot faster. So, you know, if you look at how to make a fusion power plant right now based on existing technology, I agree that this a fusion power plant is a very difficult thing to right now it's probably impossible with the materials that we have now, without developing new materials, so without or the limits in technology that we have now. But that doesn't mean that if you have a lot of people working in this area, a lot of good people, then they can figure out how to do it. But we need to demonstrate first that we have a fusion fuel that works and provides energy.
Okay, Michael Campbell.
Now, so I Ricardo's point about demonstrating that fusion works at a scale that can be believed to be economic is the key. I mean, we know it works in the sun. We know it works in thermonuclear weapons. We need to show it at a scale that can make it an economically viable energy source. So how big must the laser be to do it? So we have to demonstrate that. So that's a very key thing. But then my belief also is sort of what Ricardo said. There's a good book that came out recently about the Wright brothers by David McCullough. And until they demonstrated flight, and now they demonstrated flight, you know, with a tiny little engine and wooden cloth and riding on a desk chair. They would never imagined that in the future you'd be taking hundreds of people across the country in a plane, in a jet plane flying at 35,000 feet, that it was safer than any other mode of transportation, using materials that they couldn't have imagined. Composite materials didn't exist when the Wright brothers happened. A low-cost aluminum didn't exist, power plants didn't exist. But the demonstration of flight and what they did over the next number of years to demonstrate it wasn't just a 20-second flight, it was flying in, they had to go to fly to Paris or Le Mans to show that the French flight was possible. People didn't believe them. They had to go to Washington to show that actually you could fly not just for 20 seconds with the wind blowing in your face, but for something meaningful. So Once we demonstrate fusion and the investments to do that are relatively small compared to other investments a country makes, then I think, as Ricardo said, you know, we should have a, there'll be a much more focused effort to make it a viable energy source. And if someone says, well, we're a lot smarter than the Wright brothers, I hold my cell phone. And when I was a kid, I never imagined talking across the world, not just talking, but listening, looking at pictures. And so to think that we have the, you know, the sort of arrogance that, well, we know a lot more now is foolish.
Americans spend $2 billion a year on Cadbury eggs. You know, so you're right. The overall investments on fusion research are probably small in comparison to a lot of things. Arijit, go ahead.
So I would like to add another aspect to investments in fusion research. Like, we build a lot of these lasers to do fusion. Yes, that's the primary objective. But other than that, they also do a lot of basic science research and material, in like other kind of research, which of warm, high density matter, which brings out a lot of basic physics, which no one knows of yet. Because without these lasers, we cannot probe matter at those extreme conditions. And I think that is a very, very important thing that should be kept in mind, because that those investigations could lead to some other discoveries, which could lead to very important like discoveries in the end. So that should also be kept in mind.
Yeah, and when Jake says, you know, we could be decades away, that feels a little bit like a failure of imagination of the human mind to understand where we are in timescales. Decades are nothing in the history of this planet. I mean, really, really nothing. It feels like forever to us because we're all impatient and we look at fission and that took 3 years. Sometimes decades of achievement may seem like they take forever, but they take you to a different place. The other side of that coin is when you hear Ricardo say, we don't know, or Michael say, we don't know if fusion will be, quote unquote, too late for climate change. That's the open question. But I would just say, you know, my observation, Jake, in looking at this as a problem, imagine you're in a house that's on fire, but the fire is burning slowly. Doesn't mean that it's not going to take your house down eventually. You've got some people who are spraying a squirt gun at it, trying to get that fire to stop, others who are trying to blow it out with their breath. But in the corner, you've got some people who in your family who are working on a project that if it works, they can flip a switch and the fire will stop immediately. Now, you don't know if they're going to get it done in time by the time your house burns down, but you wouldn't tell them to stop working on it. You would just make sure there are other people doing other work to stop the flames. You know, and that's where we are with fusion. Who knows exactly where sort of the end point of climate, there's no end point, but sort of a too late point is. I just think, you know, thinking on a decade scale is a little bit of a failure of the imagination of time. He does follow up to say, these laser experiments are interesting, but I hope your guests talk about the Wendelstein 7X Stellarator a bit. Yeah. He says, ignition is tough enough. The real problem is confinement. All right, now, Jake, you're beyond me. And I always seed the ground and say, I know what I don't know, and I don't know what he's talking about. So, guest, do you want to help us, sir?
So the Wendelstein is the Stellarator. The Wendelstein Stellarator is a brand new German machine that just has been operating for a relatively short time, I think 6 months or so. It's actually now has been upgraded already for better experiments. So belongs to a different approach to fusion. It's called magnetic confinement instead of a laser fusion. That's what we are pursuing here at Rochester. The reason why there are these two different approaches is basically it has to do with the fact that to ignite fusion fuel, you had to heat it up to temperatures of tens of millions of degrees. So if you have something at tens of millions of degrees, then you cannot hold it in a solid container. So then if you want to hold it, you had to make sure that it doesn't touch anything. And so you can hold it with magnetic fields. Because this heated fusion fuel is made of charged particles, because at these temperatures the electrons are stripped from the ions, and so you can hold them, since it's charged, you can hold them together with a magnetic field. And so basically, so this is one approach, is the magnetically confined plasma approach. The Stellarator is one particular confinement. Magnetic confinement system. It seems very promising with respect to a more standard confinement system. It's called the tokamak that people have been working on for a long time also. And it is promising. and we can talk about the details if you're interested in, but the problem with these confinement systems, they work at actually very low pressure compared to our system. They work at pressures of atmospheres, which is pressures that we know what that means, so there's nothing unusual about it. But the problem with the magnetically confined plasma is that they lose energy very quickly through the magnetic field. So it's very difficult to hold that temperature together in the plasma at steady state for a long time, okay, because it just leaks through. So, you know, so, you can use an analogy of holding sand with a net, just the sand goes through. So holding a plasma with a magnetic field, then the plasma leaks energy through the magnetic field lines. And so it's
difficult.
And then
what happens?
And then it quenches. So it doesn't ignite.
So you don't reach the ignition point. Okay.
So the other approach that's what we use is, we had to have a plasma at this tens of millions of degrees. And so we are not going to confine it. We are not going to hold it together. We are going to try to burn that plasma as much as we can the very short time where the plasma sits there, okay, before it basically expands because it's so hot, it will expand. But during that time, we try to get as many fusion reactions as possible. So the plasma basically sits there at those temperatures only because it has some finite inertia. So it doesn't disappear immediately. It disappears on a billionth of a second. But that time is enough to trigger a large amount of fusion reactions. So that is the inertial confinement approach. That's what we pursue with the lasers.
All right. I, not to get too deep into the weeds here, but the stellarators and the magnets, is there a hope to eventually not have sand going through a net? I mean, are there ways to fix that?
The most obvious way is just make it bigger. So it takes longer for the energy to flow from the center of the plasma throughout the edge of the plasma.
So you maintain a fusion. You maintain fusion for longer.
For longer
it
time,
stops.
Just to make it bigger. So size. So the Wandelstein Stellarator is a very big machine, and the next large machine that the magnetically confined researchers are building is called ITER. It's a tokamak, but it's gigantic. It's costing tens of billions of dollars in south of France. So that's an international collaboration.
Okay, so again, Jake, thanks for that, and very interesting stuff in terms of what's viable and the different approaches to fusion. It's not a one-size-fits-all fusion world in terms of the science research, and so let's go back to what's going on at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics. Our guests told us about some of the recent work, and Michael, go ahead.
Just one question again. I think you made a very good point about how long, a few decades or short amounts
sure.
of time. The Stellarator was invented by Lyman Spitzer in Princeton in the early 1950s. And it went into basically hiatus because the technology to make the magnetic fields and the accuracy required was not there. And so now it's been reborn because the technology and the computer designs to be able to make the magnetic fields have reinvented the Stellarator. But, you know, it started in the early 50s and actually was abandoned because technology wasn't ready for it then. So it just shows you the pace of fusion research.
Sure, absolutely.
But there are some very interesting results coming out of the Wandelstein, very preliminary, because their plasma is really low performance. They have to upgrade the machine for high-performance plasmas. But there are very interesting results. They are going to actually discuss this in the upcoming meeting in about a month in San Jose, California.
And as Deng Xiaoping once said, whether the cat's black or white, as long as it catches mice.
Well, you know, I was curious about that just because when we talk about a science landscape where funding can be harder to come by and there's people researching fusion, and whether it's with a Stellarator or in a laser lab, is it competitive? I mean, that's sort of a strange question to ask. It feels like, of course, it's competitive. But what you're indicating, Michael, is that it's more of a team of researchers trying different things, but everyone working toward a same kind of a goal. How do you view it?
Yeah, no, it's competitive but supportive. I mean, I think that's the way I look at it. The United States, for example, is the dominant player in inertial fusion, as Ricardo was describing and Luigi was describing. We are the dominant, the country in the world with the most advanced science and technology in this. In the magnetic fusion world, U.S. is one of the major players, but Europe and Asia spend more money on that. So again, it's more of an international competition. But, you know, we all want the same thing. We all want to be able to demonstrate this as a viable energy source in the future. But there are many ways to do it.
All right. Well, let's get back then to the Laboratory for Laser Energetics, because we talked about some of the recent work there. And I want to talk about what happens next with it, or how it can be applied, and what the implications are. So, Ricardo and Origen, sure. I think you can help with that.
Let me acknowledge that all the recent results, all the results coming out of the Laboratory for Laser Energetics, the exciting results, are really the work of a large dedicated group of scientists and engineers. So the three of us are here to talk about it, but we're really, a small fraction of the total. There is very, very good people at the Laser Lab doing outstanding work. And those are very complicated experiments. So not a single person can run these experiments. I mean, the laser is a very complicated facility to run. So we have a group of engineers, outstanding engineers, that run the facility. There are targets that needs to be made. And so they are a group of people that just devoted to make very, very complicated targets. And then there are people like myself that looks at the results to try to make sense of it. And Arijit, what is done is taken the results from the Rochester laser and then extrapolate it to the Livermore laser, which is almost 70 times bigger in terms of energy. And the Rochester laser are big lasers. So if you the Livermore laser is an incredibly large facility. And so with Arijit, through computer simulations, is able to predict what would happen if we repeat these experiments at Lawrence Livermore. With some caveats, because extrapolation is such a large extrapolation, and so there are some caveats with the extrapolation. But basically, this is what we have done. Now, what we have demonstrated at Rochester recently, and extrapolating to the Livermore laser, is that we have generated a spark in the fusion fuel that is actually doubled in size before quenching. So for the first time, the spark didn't die immediately. Okay, and the spark was a spark of 50 billion atmospheres of pressure. And based on the calculation, the spark is 100 billion atmospheres rather than 50, so it's a factor of 2 in pressure. This spark would grow indefinitely and propagate it through the entire fuel. So this is the importance of the results. For the first time, we were able to make a spark that we think, if replicated at Lawrence Livermore, it will grow in size by a factor of 2. Now, the question is, can we make it in such a way that it doesn't stop propagating? It would just grow indefinitely.
Right, and the reason why we cannot do these experiments that we are doing here at Lawrence Livermore is because Lawrence Livermore, the laser system, is built in such a way such that it's machined to do indirect drive. And it's very difficult to do direct drive, like using the lasers directly to drive the target, symmetrically at Lawrence Livermore. So that is something that we are doing at Rochester. But our laser system at Rochester is much smaller, 70 times, like Ricardo said, smaller than at Livermore. So what we do here is we do experiments at a smaller scale, and we try to see what would happen if we extrapolate what we get experimentally over here to that big laser system, which is a difficult extrapolation process, and it does have a lot of assumptions, and so we are not saying that is foolproof yet, but it's something that we should think about, and that may be a path forward. That is what we are trying to put through these extrapolation, and what we get here is we show that, given these conditions that we have in Rochester, which is a smaller facility, we could actually replicate the same experiments that they already have done at Livermore using a different approach. So we are at par. That is what we tried to show using our paper.
I think just to reset what Ricardo said, this really is based upon lots of people's work. There's the work that Ricci did was basically on taking the results that scientists at Rochester done, Sean Reagan and Valery Goncharov, which was published in a prestigious journal, and then what would happen if it was moved to NIF. And not only would we light the spark, as Ricardo said, and keep it, and it would double, but it would produce roughly 5 times more fusion energy than is done with the indirect driver approach because of this efficiency improvement that Origi said. And so Whereas NIF, the previous article that you referred to, had produced roughly 25 kilojoules of energy. This would produce maybe 125 if the physics extrapolation took place. And what we look at, Omega sort of is like a wind tunnel. In the early days of aerodynamics, people would, before they would build the plane, they'd build the wind tunnel. And they would have a mock of the plane, the wind tunnel, which had all the physical variables in there that would scale to the plane. It was critical in the development of flight. The Wright brothers built wind tunnels. People don't know that, which is critical in their development. So Omega, these experiments at a smaller scale, would extrapolate to this improved performance in terms of yield. But it shows the viability of both approaches is our feeling on this. But it does show the advantage of direct drive if we were able to do this. And we are studying right now with Livermore to convert NIF to symmetric to direct drive configuration. Part of the research that Ricci and Ricardo and others are doing at Rochester provides the basis for justifying looking at NIF to do direct drive as a principal approach.
All right, let me get a few more listener questions in. Mike in Rochester has a question for the panel. Go ahead, Mike.
Good afternoon. My question has to do with the suspension of the experiment and whether it could happen in outer space, like the sun is somehow suspended in outer space. But you may have answered it already with reference to the requirement of significant atmospheric pressure. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Mike.
The answer, yes. Fusion. These processes could be done in outer space, and actually there is a reasonable number of people who have looked at making fusion as a rocket engine, as an energy source for advanced propulsion systems. So the answer is yes, this would easily work in outer space. The question is, make it work first on Earth, and then, there are obviously opportunities for fusion other than just energy production that could be used for propulsion systems.
I wonder if our listeners, our astute listeners, are going back to a conversation with Adam Frank, astrophysicist from the University of Rochester, who just a few weeks ago on this program was talking about the discovery of this exoplanet in the nearest star system, Alpha Centauri, its Proxima B, and it would only take something like 200,000 years to get there if we left now, based on what we have. But he said eventually we might have advanced propulsion systems that can get us there a lot faster, maybe within 20 years or so. And I wonder if fusion will be behind that. So,
well, fusion is one of is probably the most advanced concept, because fusion can also, it can do much better than chemical rockets in terms of the exhaust velocity it can produce and the speed in which a rocket could eventually get to.
That's why we need fusion, not just for climate change here. If we ever want to go live on that rock, we're going to need something better. A couple more quick points here on Twitter here. Dave writes, fusion has been 30 years in the future for 50 years, so you'll excuse my skepticism. We covered that, Dave. We all know that's the joke, but they're trying to work around that.
We are trying to change that.
Absolutely. David writes to us and says, we played basketball for decades before we got Michael Jordan. What is the budget for fusion? Would tripling the budget get us there faster?
Well, it's not just an issue of money. Right. Of course, money helps, but it's not just an issue of money. So I think there is. So we have the facilities for laser fusion. We have the facilities to explore the possibility of igniting fusion fuel for the first time in the laboratory. We are not talking about. I mean, having some additional funding and nothing large would help in that endeavor. But we have the facilities.
Okay.
So at this point, I mean, the tripling on the fusion budget or quadrupling, of course, would help, and it's probably necessary once we demonstrate the fusion fuel does work and we need to develop the engineering for a power plant.
I think it's also very important, like, that we should reach out to the younger generation and make them aware of fusion so that a lot of new and bright people come into this field and try to achieve fusion.
You chose it. I mean, there's a lot of emphasis on other forms of energy for our energy future. You chose to focus on fusion. Why, Arigin?
Yes, actually, going back to what we started our discussion about, it's about global warming, which is a big problem. And if we want to make our planet Earth survive for a long time, and then we have to come up with an alternative way, because global warming, as everyone knows, is a big issue. So, and what else? So we have to think about other alternative ways, and I think fusion is a very promising way.
And I think your generation cares deeply about this. So if you sell this to incoming students as the ultimate, maybe it works. 30 seconds, a quick lightning round here. John wants to know, I've heard that fusion will make the confinement container highly radioactive. Yes or no?
Not highly. It's actually low-level radioactivity. So nothing like uranium fuel for fission.
Okay.
Nothing like that.
Sean says, any comment on Lockheed Martin's claim to be just a few years away? Did they say that?
Well, that is something I was on the car ride. We were saying that in fusion, every 6 or 7 years, there is somebody claiming a fusion breakthrough that has solved all the problems. So that was one of them, but not really solved.
And sometimes that's just hype. Listen, I think what you've gotten this hour is a sober view of fusion, but not a pessimistic one. And Arijit Bose, good luck as a PhD candidate working on this. Thanks for being
here.
Thank you. It's been great fun here. Michael Campbell, Deputy Director of the Laboratory for Laser Energetics. Thank you, Michael. And Ricardo Betti, a professor and scientist at the Laboratory of Laser Energetics. Great learning from you as well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Let's get a short break and more connections next.